Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 24th of April. White House ghosts, presidents and their speechwriters from FDR to George W. Bush. A highly interesting book written by Robert Schlesinger, Deputy Assistant Managing Editor of Opinion at U.S. News and World Report, a position that Robert just started fairly recently. Formerly political editor of the insider publication The Hill, a Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. He has written for the Washington Monthly, for Salon.com, the Weekly Standard, for People. He teaches political journalism at Boston University's Washington Journalism Center. And he's written mostly about presidents since FDR, because that's when we have, you know, the radio and the television and all of that. But he also has some interesting things to say about the farewell address from George Washington and who was in on that, and Andrew Jackson, and a little bit about Abraham Lincoln, my favorite guy, of course, Harding and Coolidge. And he goes beyond because he has a blog, too. So he looks at the political rhetoric of some of those people who were running for office right now, and highlights the significant oratorical skills of Barack Obama, which most people would agree with depending on your independent of your political views. He believes that presidential speeches are important to educate and persuade the public and to force decisions and clarify policies within the executive branch. Schlesinger believes that by divorcing speechwriters from policymaking, recent presidents may be depriving themselves of a useful tool for achieving their objectives. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him and tell you more about an upcoming appearance in Milwaukee he will have. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's talk about those speeches. I wonder if I'm of an era, because I'm getting pretty old here, where those speeches, I've sat glued to speeches, and I still do, and I'm moved by uplifting words and moved by ideas that presidents can offer us. Do we still place importance, the American people, that is, on those words?
Oh, I think there's no question. Certainly, we're so inundated with stimuli and different forms of entertainment that it's harder for any politician, even a president, to punch through.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's no question. I mean, how many times have we sat and discussed the famous Bush's famous 16 words and regarding you allocate uranium in Niger,
right?
And the president has a unique ability to speak to the country and persuade or a good president knows how to use that tool.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with some of the early presidents. I know the book concentrates on those FDR and beyond, but tell me about the kind of help that George Washington had with his very famous farewell speech.
This is one of the things I found fascinating in writing White House Ghosts was it goes all the way back.
Yeah.
Washington, after one term in 1796, he considered stepping down, and he wrote a draft of the farewell address, and said and had James Madison help him, and then he obviously did not step down. He served a second term, and after the end of the second term, he pulled out the draft and sent it over to Alexander Hamilton, and got some help from him. I think that's a pretty sterling set of speechwriters to have Madison and Hamilton. The funny thing is, the speech was never actually delivered as a speech. It was his farewell address, but it was printed in newspapers, and that was how it was sort of disseminated around the country.
Mm-hmm. You write about Lincoln's first and second inaugural addresses, I think, are masterpieces, but that he had a suggestion that he add a note of fraternal affection to that speech. Given to him, which got worked around. He finally got the final phrase, and he got the final phrase right. But even Lincoln, who did most of his writing, had suggestions every now and then.
Yeah, for his first inaugural, the suggestion of fraternal affection came from his incoming Secretary of State, William Seward, who gave him some lines about the mystic chords about Mystic Chords, which Lincoln then polished into the lines we know so well about the mystic chords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it shows that even the most just remarkably talented presidents in terms of their ability to use language, everyone can use a little help now and again. And most presidents, right up to, even when there were not speechwriters on staff, many of them would occasionally get help.
Mm-hmm. Who gave the best speeches?
Oh, I think you have to look at FDR. I'm talking about the modern presidents.
You have to
look at at FDR. You have to look at JFK. I think you have to look at Reagan. And I think those are the big three. I think Bill Clinton is sort of not quite up there, but is certainly was very good. But I think those are the big three.
Mm-hmm. And how often have these people, sometimes very much behind the scenes and hidden, and sometimes out there so people know they were writing, how often have they come up with these phrases, the New Deal, the New Frontier, putting a presidency, usually when they're starting off, as a new direction, and it stays with us forever?
Yeah, it's a remarkable mixed bag in terms of that. And this is another one of the fun things was writing White House Ghosts was figuring out where these things came from. And in some cases, like New Deal, was a inadvertent invention by a Roosevelt speechwriter named Sam Rosenman, who included it in the peroration. The closing to FDR's acceptance speech in 1932 for accepting the Democratic nomination, and neither he nor FDR thought, we have this phrase that will encapsulate the administration.
Right. Yeah.
And it just stuck. And then there are some times when a president or a speechman, Harry Truman, came up with Fair Deal, and again, it was one of those things where it wasn't. He said, I got it. But it just came out in the flow of words, and it ended up standing out and sticking.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you'll get cases where one of the surprisingly fun chapters to write of White House Ghosts was the Carter administration chapter, Carter had just surprisingly talented speechwriters, people like Hendrik Hertzberg and James Fallows and Chris Matthews. But Carter never went in for rhetorical or oratory or rhetoric, and Hendrik Hertzberg kept saying, he would send in memos saying, "We've got to come up with some phrase like New Deal and Fair Deal and New Frontier that captures this what the administration is all about." And they finally came up with New Foundation, and the whole administration made a big push to get New Foundation as sort of the catchphrase. And the cartoon Doonesbury did a whole week on it, and it was really going. And at a press conference, a reporter says, "Mr. President, your administration's been talking about New Foundation, and you mentioned it in the State of the Union a dozen times. Is this the theme of the administration?" And Carter says, "No."
Oh, no.
And just, there it goes.
You talk about the presidents, George Herbert Walker Bush being one of them, Harry Truman, I think, maybe being another. I may be off on Harry Truman. Ford, Gerald Ford, certainly one of them. And now, as you've mentioned, Carter, who just didn't think speeches were all that important. They didn't like giving them. They didn't like to use highfalutin language. They just didn't realize how powerful they could be.
Yeah, and I think it's no mistake that Carter and George Herbert Walker Bush, especially, are the two one-term presidents of the modern presidents.
Hmm.
Truman was a fascinating one to write about in White House Ghosts because he understood the importance of public speaking, but his problem was that he couldn't actually read a speech.
Hmm.
He had terrible eyesight.
Oh.
He had a sort of a nasal drone that would go on and kind of put people to sleep, and he had awkward hand motions as he tried to read a speech. He would read down and bend his head over so that his audience could only see the top of his head, and then he'd jerk up and try to connect with the audience, and he'd lose his place in the speech. But what his speech writers hit on, his staffers hit on, was that he was great at talking, and he was great at speaking to crowds, just not when he was bound to a text.
Hmm.
So in 1948, this is one of the secrets of the famous Dewey beats Truman election and the whistle stop tour, was they would basically give him talking points.
Hmm.
And you know, here are the high points you want to hit, Mr. President, and he would go.
Hmm.
And you know, he was spectacularly effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I never thought of that. Of course, if you can't see very well, it's very hard to give a speech.
Yeah, exactly. And hmm. he didn't have it in the way that, you know, he was following FDR, who had practically reinvented presidential speech giving.
Mm-hmm.
And the key thing for him was, he and his aides figuring out, well, no, he wasn't going to speak like FDR. He was going to speak like Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got that, he took off.
Hmm. And a lot of the speechwriters, those who are particularly successful, there's a theme to them, isn't there, that they really understand who it is they're writing for. They
yep.
understand the cadence of the way they speak. They understand what their vision is. They essentially become sort of a part of who the president is.
There was a great description by Richard Goodwin, who was a speechwriter for President Kennedy and then later for President Johnson. He was talking about, Goodwin was the speechwriter who did the Johnson's famous "We Shall Overcome" speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "My job was not limited to guessing what the president might say exactly as he would express it, but to heighten and polish, hmm. illuminate, as it were, his inward beliefs and natural idiom, to attain not a strained mimicry, but an authenticity of expression. I would not have written the same speech in the same way for Kennedy or any other politician or for myself. But it was by me, but it was for and of the Lyndon Johnson I'd carefully studied and come to know." So I think that captures perfectly the role of a speechwriter, is getting inside the boss's head and figuring out, not simply figuring out what they would say, but then helping them elevate their game, as it were.
Right. And how many of them, how many more were intricately involved in helping to develop policy? So when you're writing a speech, you're also talking about what the policy is going to be, and how many were just wordsmiths?
Well, that's one of the things that was interesting to trace in White House Ghosts, was how that has changed over the years. And as you said, I start with FDR, and his speechwriters were policy advisors, or it's probably more accurate to say that his policy advisors were speechwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more or less the case into the Johnson administration. And when you look at famous examples like JFK's speechwriter was Ted Sorensen, who was his chief domestic policy aide. In the Johnson administration, you had high-level policy people like Jack Valenti and Joseph Califano and Bill Moyers were writing speeches, but you also had the administration was doing so much that they had they said, we just need to hire full-time speechwriters to handle all the little stuff.
Hmm.
And then starting with Johnson and progressing through the modern presidents into especially Reagan and the first President Bush, there's a growing split where under the Reagan administration, and this is another thing that I've just found really interesting about in writing White House Ghosts, was we think of the famous Reagan expressions like evil empire, we will leave communism in the ash heap of history, or tear down this wall,
mm-hmm.
or even win one for the Gipper.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of these cases, there's the backstory is that the speechwriters were having terrific struggles with the senior policy people, where the speechwriters were the Reaganite conservatives, and the senior policy people were more moderate, and they were saying, we can't have President Reagan say these things.
Hmm.
But of course, you know, these were Reagan-esque things to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then under the first President Bush, the speechwriters didn't even, I mean, they didn't have enough passes to go around to get to the West Wing to actually either see the president speak or talk to him about what he wanted to say. But in the last couple of administrations, the Clinton administration and the second Bush administration, it's swung back a little bit, where they are more integrated and there's more policy speechwriter sort of cross-pollination.
Mm-hmm. You write about Reagan was a marvelous speechmaker, I think, and part of it was just the eyes, the twinkles in the eyes. You know, he had this Irish way of endearing you to him. He had the gift of gab. But it's also true, you say, that he had a fairly identifiable ideology. So being a speechwriter for him, even though the speechwriters, nobody was very close to the guy, they could write for him because they knew at least who his public persona was.
That's exactly right. Where I think the two examples you can take in terms of presidents and speechwriters are JFK and Sorensen. On the one hand, where Sorensen could finish JFK's sentences, and they spent years traveling the country together before JFK became president, and you know, Sorensen was just knew his boss perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
With the Reagan speechwriters, like you said, they didn't know him as well. They didn't have that kind of intimate relationship. But they did have a long policy record. He had been giving speeches for 15 or 20 years publicly before he went to the White House, and so he had a clear ideology and a clear voice, and they could know him very well that way. The other thing they did, which I discussed in White House Ghosts, is they had a back channel to his private secretary, and Reagan would write a lot of letters to people around the country. And so they would arrange to get copies of the letters just so they could see what he was writing about and how he was writing and this sort of thing.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls for Robert, and we'll take them in just one moment. Robert Schlesinger is our guest. He is the author of the just-released and highly interesting book, White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters, from FDR to George W. Bush. He has just recently become Deputy Assistant Managing Editor of Opinion at U.S. News and World Report. He's formerly political editor of the insider publication The Hill and a Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's written for The Washington Monthly, Salon.com, The Weekly Standard, and People. He teaches at Boston University's Washington Journalism Center, where he teaches political journalism. So let's look at some of these great speeches. And, you know, you can go back a little bit. The book starts more with – well, the book actually starts with George Washington, as it would. But there's more time spent when we had radio and television and presidents were giving more speeches of more importance. Who had the input? Who is secretive about letting the American people know that they had speech writers, that they would prefer for us to think that they wrote these marvelous words themselves? He also writes in some of his blogs about Barack Obama's speech-making ability. He looks at, all of the presidents and how some of them didn't take their speeches as very big things. They just kind of wanted to get them over with, but that a well-made speech, a well-delivered speech, is a crucial part of the presidency and getting us behind public policy and in helping to formulate public policy. So think of some of the speeches that stay in your mind. Oh, we have to go to the military-industrial complex. So it's interesting. Within 3 days, we had that speech, and then we had Kennedy's inaugural speech. So we'll look at those as we continue. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send us an email, you could do that, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Lines are open. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Some lines open now if you'd like to join the conversation, maybe for me to phrase the question, what do you think was the best delivered, best crafted presidential speech that you have ever heard or you have ever read? You can go way back if you'd like. Our number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in the Milwaukee area. And our guest is the author of White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters, from FDR to George W. Bush. Robert Schlesinger is our guest. And as the phone calls come in, let's spend a little bit of time on George W. Bush, who, according to you, recognizes the importance of speeches and puts a great deal of time and energy into speech preparation and has a great deal of faith in his speechwriters.
No, he had a front row seat watching the demise of his father's administration.
Mm.
And one of the lessons he obviously took was, you know, his father kind of downplayed the importance of speech writing and speech giving. And President Bush has obviously put an emphasis on it. And he, in his first term, had what he called the troika of speechwriters, one of whom was Michael Gerson, who was his chief speechwriter. Another was a fellow named Matthew Scully, who is now writing speeches for John McCain, actually. And the third was a Wisconsinite, actually, named John McConnell, who was technically Vice President Cheney's speechwriter. But the three of them would either edit or write virtually all of the speeches that the president gave in his first term.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. We'll start with Jim from Waukesha. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi. Well,
what a wonderful topic. I'd like to ask your guest about two speeches. John Kennedy spoke at American University June of 63 or May in a speech that is justly famous and wonderfully inspiring. Then, months later, he had a speech in his pocket at the moment he was killed. And It is almost the polar opposite. A lot of saber rattling and braggadocio. Well, I wouldn't call it braggadocio, but he was letting the world know what kind of president he would be as he started his 64 campaign. But I thought he had been doing that before at American University. Could you do a little compare and contrast of those speeches and tell me whether they were both written by the same speechwriter?
You know, I actually, in White House Ghosts, don't get into the speech he was going to give on November 22nd, but the American University speech, which is one of the great pieces of eloquence and discussions, contemplations of peace and war and during the Cold War, you know, where he said, "If we cannot now end our differences, at least we can make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic link is that we all inhabit this small planet. Mm. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal." That was drafted, as were most of Kennedy's speeches, by Ted Sorensen, who, you know, again having discussed it with his boss, they'd been discussing it for a couple of months, and Kennedy, you know, wanted to give a speech on the importance of peace, and Kennedy had been on a swing around the country, and Sorensen was back in D.C. Working on the speech, and Sorensen worked with a small group of people and basically cut out the Pentagon and cut out the State Department, which illustrated exactly how close he was to the president, that he didn't, you know, in these days wouldn't happen. You couldn't simply not include them in this sort of planning. But Sorensen did the writing and flew out to meet his boss the day before the speech, and they spent the plane ride back to Washington going over the speech. And you know, it was actually one of the people who would occasionally write speeches for the president and was a little bit involved in that speech was my late father, Arthur Schlesinger, who was a Kennedy aide.
Yes.
And he later wrote in his journal, "I suppose that from the viewpoint of orderly administration, this was a bad way to prepare a major statement on foreign policy. But the State Department could never in 1,000 years have produced the speech. The president is fortunately ready from time to time to assert control over the policy of his administration, however deeply it may offend the bureaucracy." And it was a great example of you know, speech writing done well and how it worked there in that administration.
And I think that the other speech, well, I think Washington was probably the only place he could have given the June speech. And Texas demanded that he give the other speech with the saber rattling.
Yeah, and there were other examples of you know, where things would, you know, where there were, the rhetoric would was not always in that same vein. I mean, if you look at his speech in Berlin, at the Berlin Wall, the Ich bin ein Berliner speech, which JFK essentially extemporized, that was much more the tough, cold warrior. People say we can deal with the communists. Well, let them come to Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's another great story which I cover in White House Ghosts, where flying into Berlin, he scribbled down the phrases "Ich bin ein Berliner," "Lass sie nach Berlin kommen," and then driving to the event, he showed the commanding general in Berlin his speech draft that he had, and the general, he said, "What do you think?" And the general said, "This isn't very good, Mr. President." And JFK essentially gets up there and off the cuff deliver. I mean, he had had written down the phrases in German, but essentially gave this stirring, remarkable speech off the top of his head.
Amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Well, thanks for your book. I'm going to look forward to reading it.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're the perfect audience for it. Did you and your dad dissect speeches and listen to them together?
No, unfortunately, I didn't get the chance. He was very helpful and gave me writing tips and let me read his journals and saw and closely edited the first drafts of the first couple of chapters of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he died, unfortunately, during the writing process.
Mm-hmm. What about the military-industrial complex speech? So many people remember that phrase, and it's brought up how many years later? A long time. Tell us the story of that speech.
That's a really interesting one. Eisenhower's chief speechwriter at the time was a former professor named Malcolm Moose, and he had a couple of deputy speechwriters, one of whom was a naval assistant named Ralph Williams. And what Moose would do was he would kind of bandy ideas around, and his deputies would send in ideas. And in late 1960, Williams sends in a memo talking about the problem of militarism. He noted that, quote, "For the first time in its history, the United States has a permanent war-based industry." And not only that, but flag and general officers retiring at an early age take positions in a war-based industrial complex, shaping its decisions and guiding the direction of its tremendous thrust. And so this was, you know, Moose said, this is a good topic for a speech. And they worked on it a little bit. They went back and forth with Eisenhower on it. At one point, it was the military-industrial-scientific complex. At one point, it was the military-industrial-congressional complex. Of course, they eventually ends up being the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting kind of coda to the whole story is that it didn't get a lot of coverage. I mean, everyone's big focus was on JFK's inaugural, which is going to be a few days after that, and Eisenhower was, in a sense, old news.
Oh, interesting.
And Walter Lippmann was one of the few people who said, you know, this is going to be, we're going to remember the speech and quote it for a long time.
Huh.
But really, it didn't get any headlines.
And that's because there was so much focus on a new administration,
right,
the
new
Camelot.
Generation and et cetera, et cetera.
Huh.
And then months after, it starts to bubble up again and people start to pay attention to it. And you know, so it's sometimes hard to know what's going to stick and what's not. And what's,
right.
You know, the stirring speech of 2 days ago that you think might be, we'll always remember this.
Right.
2 months from now, no one might remember.
Right. And now we got how many years later and we still remember it and talk about it.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable. Or the Gettysburg Address. The speech will be a little noted.
Another perfect example where, you know, Lincoln wasn't the headliner there. He was just giving a brief undercard, and the main attraction was, I can't remember his name. But again, you know, that just summarizes it. I can't
exactly
remember the guy who was the main attraction.
Right. And the other guy gives a 2-minute speech, and we all have it memorized
exactly.
Or learned it when we were in school. Thanks so much, Jim, for the call. Let's go to Keith from Port Edwards. Hi, Keith.
Yes, thank you for taking my phone call. You had mentioned the fact that Harry Truman, because of eyesight, was not an effective speaker. And I guess I feel like George W. Bush, in his capacity to give a speech, you know, it seems like he flounders and looks down. He might have a good speech, but I guess the other thing is that I feel like those speeches are quite repetitious. But I will give him a plus in that the fact when he gave the eulogy for Mrs. Ford at the National Cathedral, I felt like he did an extremely good job. So I'll listen to you.
Well, I think President Bush can give a good speech when he practices it, and if it's sort of a major set piece speech. And I think his speech of September 20th, 2001, after the 9/11 attacks, was an example of a very well written and delivered speech.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know of his verbal fumbles and things like nuclear and mangled phraseology, and so he's very uneven in that sense. But what I was saying was earlier was that he may not always be able to give a good speech, but he understands the importance of it. Whereas his father had kind of downplayed it and just never really understood the importance of the bully pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a great scene in White House Ghosts regarding that September 20th speech. There was a speechwriter in the current Bush administration who had also been a speechwriter in the Clinton administration, had been on the National Security Council and had asked to stay on and had been kept on. He later told me that it was like going into work the first day of the Bush administration. He felt like he was on the roof of the Saigon embassy and all of his friends had caught the last helicopter out.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept in touch, obviously, with his former Clinton colleagues. And after 9/11, preparing for the September 20th speech, he was one of the people contributing to it. One of his former Clinton boss sent him some suggested language, and there was a phrase in there that he liked, and so he took it and sent it in, and into the Bush September 20th speech it went. And so when Bush delivered the line, either we'll bring our enemies to justice or justice to our enemies, but justice will be done, neither he nor anyone else knew that it actually had come from a Clinton speechwriter.
Oh, my. Interesting. And let's talk about Clinton for a while. He has been touted as a masterful speaker, and he does have this warmth about him when he speaks, except recently. But I always thought he went on too long.
Well, a lot of people thought that, and that was the most famous example of that was his 1988 speech to the Democratic Convention, where he was either the keynote speaker or the nominating speaker, and he went on too long and famously came to the point where he said, in conclusion, and the audience burst into big applause.
Right.
But he would, I mean, Clinton is remarkable for his ability to work with a speech but at the same time read a crowd and riff, basically. And everyone, as I say in White House Ghosts, the phrase that I hear over and over and over again talking to his speechwriters is jazz musician. Because he will take what's on the paper and go off and riff a little bit and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't know where the written speech leaves off and the Clinton extemporizing picks up.
Mm-hmm. Keith, thanks so much for the call. We go to Scott from La Crosse next. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Good morning to you both. I would like to ask about somebody that I thought was one of the current Bush speechwriters in the first term, and I didn't hear you mention as part of the troika, I don't think, David Frum,
yep.
Who, as I understand, was at least claimed to be the originator of the axis of evil line. Was that in the State of the Union, I think?
Yeah, it was in the 2002 State of the Union. And as with so many of these things that I cover in White House Ghosts, there's you know, a little bit more to the story. Frum was indeed a speechwriter, and he came up with a line describing the Iran and Iraq and North Korea axis of hatred.
Hmm.
He came up with axis of hatred, and focusing on Iraq and terrorist groups. And Condoleezza Rice said, "Well, we don't want to single out Iraq because we don't want to tip our hand that we're about to, you know, about what we're planning to do. So let's throw North Korea and Iran in there as well."
Hmm.
And then the Troika are sitting there putting the speech together, and Matthew Scully, who is this fascinating pro animal rights guy who wrote a whole book making a conservative argument for animal rights, he says, "I hate hatred. I hate hatred."
Hmm.
And so he says, "Well, how about evil instead of hatred?"
Hmm.
And he later wrote, "For a time, I congratulated myself on at least preventing the even more melodramatic axis of hatred from marching into history. Though looking back, I suppose axis of evil was a case of how the very intensity of these speeches could sometimes give events a false momentum and fill the air with needless drama."
Interesting. It sure did. It sure did.
And can I ask just one more quick question?
Sure, yeah. Scott.
I for some reason, have always kind of liked Harry Truman. And when you mentioned about giving him talking points, it endeared him even more to me. I just kind of like the idea of, you know, a guy getting up there who can't really read a speech, but he can certainly hit the high notes. But when I was, you know, I taught for a while and did a number of things like that where I would do some public speaking, and I always found that it was much harder for me to give a set speech, and that if I had a bunch of points I just wanted to hit and rambled along and got to them, that it always seemed to be a much more effective way of delivering what I had to say. And I was wondering, are there other people other presidents like Harry Truman for whom that was a more natural way to get information across, who would have their speechwriters do more of the bullet point kind of thing rather than the set, okay, then I say this, and then I say that, and then I say that kind of speech?
Yeah, different presidents approach it different ways, but Nixon was one who was much happier kind of memorizing the structure of a speech, memorizing the high points, and then giving it without notes. And then Clinton was also one where he could, I mean, he famously got up to give in 1993, the fall of 1993, his health care speech, proposing his health care plan. And the teleprompter comes on, and he's standing in front of Congress, the television cameras trained on him. The teleprompter comes on, and it has his State of the Union address.
Right, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
And for the first 15 or 20 minutes, he just wings it. But I love the talking about Truman and White House Ghosts, because one of the things that struck me, especially about the 48 campaign, was Truman would at every stop go out and essentially give a different speech, and he'd have his talking points, and he'd have little bits of information about whatever town he was in, and the reporters on the train would all scramble out because they wanted to know what he was going to say this time. You know, what's the president going to say here? Dewey, his opponent, the Republican nominee, would get up and at all of his appearances and give the same speech over and over and over again.
Hmm.
And the reporters were bored and didn't even bother to go listen to him.
Hmm.
And Dewey, ironically, is much more in line with a modern presidential candidate where they give the same speech.
Oh, they sure do. Particularly when the races go on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. You know, it's funny when you mention...
I think you left an ever out there.
When you mention Nixon being happier to give a speech without notes, it's hard for me to think of a happy Richard Nixon. I can't remember any speech where he appeared happier, or maybe he just, to me, never appeared happy.
Well, happy may not have been the right word to describe Nixon, but say, more comfortable, or that was what he wanted to do.
Right. Maybe he needed to be happier.
Yeah, well, I think that is almost certainly the case.
Right. Yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Thank you, Scott, very much for your interesting call. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And our guest is Robert Schlesinger. He is the author of White House Ghosts, Presidents and Their Speechwriters from FDR to George W. Bush. He's a veteran Washington reporter, formerly editor of the insider publication The Hill. He has been a Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe, has written for the Washington Monthly, Salon.com, The Weekly Standard, and People. He teaches political journalism at Boston University's Washington Journalism Center, lives in Alexandria, Virginia, and he is also now editor of The Opinion. This is a new job for him. I'm just trying to figure out where I wrote it down. The Opinion editor for U.S. News and World Report. So, more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'd like to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio is bringing in Ira Flatow, who's host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday, to Milwaukee on May 16. It's going to be a live national broadcast of his program. You can join us at the Milwaukee Public Museum May 16 from 1 until 3 for the show, and then stay for the reception to meet Ira and members of the Science Friday team. Tickets include admission to the museum, the radio broadcast, and also a reception, and there will be a ticketed VIP dinner with Ira Flatow and WPR hosts. I'll be there, and Joy will be there, Ben will be there, at Mater's Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee beginning at 5:30. Information is on our website, wpr.org/Ira. For tickets, call 414-227-2047. That's 414-227-2047. And to give it Robert due about his new title, it is Deputy Assistant Managing Editor of Opinion at U.S. News and World Report. Okay, let's go back to phone calls. Chris is next from Glendale. Hi, Chris.
I just have two unrelated comments. First, Chris Matthews of the NBC networks about 5 years ago said that when President Roosevelt was doing his fireside chat, he was really not in front of a fire. He was in a White House basement filled with technical equipment.
Huh.
And Matthews added that before these were recorded or transmitted, he would smoke a cigarette to calm his nerves, and he was facing newsmen. And Matthews described this facility as full of Army Signal Corps equipment, and it really was not the sort of glamorous image that the radio listener would have of a fireside chat.
Hmm.
Does the author know anything about this?
It changed over the years. Circumstances were obviously different in the Second World War than in the middle of the 30s and the Great Depression. I believe FDR did smoke a cigarette to calm his nerves before the speech. I think in some circumstances he was in front of a fireplace. But the thing about the fireside chats is they really illustrated how FDR had mastered the medium of radio and kind of, as I said, helped reinvent how presidents communicate with the public. Because before mass media, if you're going to see Lincoln and the guy whose name we don't remember at Gettysburg, you're probably traveling several hours to get there. You're in a crowd of thousands, so mm-hmm. the speaker has to shout basically to make sure that he's heard by the people at the back of the crowd. And you don't want a 2-minute speech. You want an hour speech because you've traveled a long way to get here, and this is your form of entertainment. With mass media like radio and television and so forth. You don't need to shout. You can do the kind of intimate, you know, I'm just sitting here in your living room in front of your fire. We're just, you know, and FDR would start all of his speeches, my friends,
and it's a completely different rhetorical and presidential communication style that FDR essentially invented.
By the way, what do you know about Robert Orban? I think he was a speechwriter for President Ford.
Robert Orban is actually another just fascinating, fun character in among the White House ghosts. He was a speechwriter for President Ford. He had started as a gag writer for Red Skelton.
Huh.
And when Ford needed to do the Gridiron Dinner, which is one of these sort of dinners here in Washington annually where the press and the politicians get together and politicians are expected to be funny. Ford has to do this dinner in 1968, and he gets referred to Orban and liked his work so much that he would bring him in periodically when he had to be funny. And when he becomes president, he brings Orban on to kind of write his opening jokes. But it turns out Orban's got a knack for just speech writing. Orban's view is it's much easier to write a speech than it is to write a joke because, people will clap at the end of the speech. They're not necessarily going to laugh at the end of the joke.
Right.
Orban is good enough that Ford eventually makes him the chief speech writer, you got to give Ford credit because he got a lot of ribbing and criticism for bringing a gag writer in to be a speechwriter. But he liked Orban's work and knew that Orban could write well for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went ahead and brought him on.
It's a great story. Thank you very much, Chris, for your informed call. We can't end the hour without talking a little bit about Barack Obama. You call him a rare, and this is in your blog, not in the book, a rare talent evoking a classic style of political speech giving. His speech on race, you talk about being remarkable for a number of reasons, not the least of which being that near nominees don't discuss race with such frankness and nuance. And, of course, there's a reason for that. What is that?
Well, the reason is that it's such a charged issue, and it's I think as a nation, it's not an issue that we're comfortable discussing, and it's so easy to have any discussion of it spiral into attacks and shorthand remarks. And Obama's speech was nuanced in a way that most politicians don't get into.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brave because there was a lot in there that could end up in attack ads in the fall. The GOP is already running in North Carolina, running attack ads on him. And it's a hell of a thing to basically hand potential weapons out and basically say to the American people, I'm going to be serious about this, and your end of the bargain is that you need to not be fooled when people try to make a political hash of this.
Right. And how many of the presidents really, obviously most of them would want the American public to believe that they wrote every single word and they're brilliant with language and brilliant with delivery. How many presidents were actually upfront about the fact that people helped them with their speeches?
Well, obviously increasingly, it's the White House ghosts are, as I say in the book, out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Even as far back as FDR, there was, people kind of knew who his speechwriters were, although all the speechwriters, no one wanted any spotlight. There are a couple of very good examples in White House ghosts where presidents weren't, shall we say, upfront about the origin of the speech. One is FDR, his inaugural address. His speechwriter then was a guy named Raymond Moley, who would later break with him, and they had a very public split.
Mm.
Moley writes the speech. He and FDR go over it and edit it. And this is a few nights before the inaugural. Moley tosses his draft onto the. FDR says, "You know what? I'm gonna copied this out by hand, because there was another aide who was very jealous, who would have been very angry if he knew that Foley was involved. It's sort of remarkable how small these things get. FDR copies it out by hand. Moley burns the draft that they had worked on together. Says, this is your speech now. Years and years later, Moley gets very angry when he sees at the FDR library the draft that FDR had copied out with a handwritten note on top of it saying, this is the speech as I wrote it, you know, on the evening of whatever the evening was, in front of the fire at Hyde Park. And everything that FDR says in this note,
we had about 5 seconds,
was true, but of course it leaves out Moley. JFK did a very similar thing with his
with Ted Sorensen.
You'll have to read the book, I guess.
Yeah, and many people will. Thanks, Robert, so much for being
with
us.
Kathy.
Thank you. Robert Schlesinger, our guest, White House Ghosts, Presidents, and Their Speechwriters. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the program, John Treader for on-air production here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.